A good stormy afternoon to you. This is Ozarks at Large on your public radio station, 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. It is Wednesday, April 28, 2021. I'm Kyle Kellums. On our program this afternoon, the deadline for the City of Fayetteville's landlord registry is approaching. Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda reports in just a few minutes. And in our second half hour, after more than a year of virtual rehearsals and classes, the Dirana Academy of Classical Dance in Rogers ready to perform again in front of an audience, socially distanced, at Walton Arts Center in Fayetteville. We'll talk with the choreographer of The Exile King, Miga Rao, about getting dancers back on stage in the second half of this show. On today's Here and Now, following Ozarks at Large, this pandemic year changed a lot about our home lives. For some, that change included drinking more than they really wanted to. Here and Now begins at 1 this afternoon. And tonight at 8, President Joe Biden will address a joint session of Congress. NPR and KUAF will provide live coverage beginning right after tonight's 7 p.m. version of our show. Storms, heavy rains, and chances of severe weather remain in our forecast for about the next 24 hours. The National Weather Service reported a tornado was on the ground early this morning in northwest Benton County, and a flash flood watch remains in effect for the region through tomorrow morning. Much of the area could receive as many as 3 inches of rain before the system exits our area, and some isolated locations could get up to 5 inches of rain. Chances of rain through tomorrow morning range from 80 to 100%. Arkansas's new cases of COVID-19 reported yesterday represent an increase over this time last week. 229 new cases in the most recent testing cycle. 5 deaths from the virus also reported. Active cases ticked upward by 39 cases. Hospitalizations dropped by 13 patients. Benton County reported the most new cases in the state, 41. Governor Asa Hutchinson says there is concern that people are not taking the virus as seriously as they might have in the past. And he stresses there are enough vaccines available for Arkansas residents 16 and older that everybody who wants one can get a shot. We'll have more from yesterday's press briefing regarding Arkansas and the virus later on our show. Rogers is the latest city to adopt an entertainment district to allow alcoholic beverages to be carried within a designated zone. The Rail Yard Entertainment District is bordered by North 3rd, West Chestnut, West Cherry, and on the west, primarily South 1st, but also South Arkansas. The district will operate in similar fashion to other such districts in the area, requiring special cups and wristbands for participants and banning any outside alcohol not purchased in the entertainment district. The City Council voted 7-1 last night to approve the creation of the district. A bill that would have eliminated voting on the Monday before an election day in Arkansas failed in the Arkansas State House. Representatives voted 43-39. On Senate Bill 485, failing to get the needed support to pass. Legislation failed multiple times in committees, but ultimately did advance through the legislature. If it had passed the House, the bill would have gone to Governor Asa Hutchinson. Speaking for the bill, Republican Representative Jack Ladyman of Jonesboro pushed back against claims it was a voter suppression bill and insisted it was an effort to assist poll workers. Democratic Representative Nicole Clowney of Fayetteville countered that the bill was indeed voter suppression because it would have made it harder for some Arkansans to vote. According to official vote tallies from the legislature, no Democrat in either chamber voted for the legislature, while those voting against the bill were bipartisan. The John Brown University women's soccer team season is over after an overtime loss in the NAIA National Championship Tournament yesterday. JBU and Central Methodist of Missouri ended the second overtime tied at 1, but Central Methodist won the penalty kick session 4-2 to advance to the national quarterfinals. This is Ozarks at Large. The deadline to submit information to the City of Fayetteville's Landlords Representative Registry is April 30th, Friday. Property owners who fail to register by Friday will be subject to fines. Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda has more.
The Fayetteville City Council unanimously approved an ordinance establishing the registry in August 2020, and the registration period opened in December. Jonathan Kurth, Development Services Director for the City of Fayetteville, says landlords with more than two long-term rental properties are required to provide the name and contact information of a designated representative to serve as a point of contact for renters and their neighbors.
And that was intended to mirror the tenets of our business license ordinance, which is set up almost the exact same way, where if you didn't have to get a business license if you had two or fewer properties that you're renting, with the idea being that you, at that point, you're not exactly a business, you're kind of doing it as a side hustle.
Kurth says the registry is intended to be a publicly accessible means of contacting a rental property owner or their representative in an effort to facilitate a prompt response to inquiries from tenants. According to the city, designated representatives should have the power to respond to questions and issues of tenants and must live or work in Washington, Benton, Crawford, or Madison County. The representative's full name, telephone number, email address, and mailing address must be submitted to the online registry. Those who do not comply are subject to fines, and Kurth says the violation process is complaints-based.
If a complaint is made, staff reviews the registry for the property. If it's not on there, we'll send a letter to the property owner, and then there'll be some back and forth to validate whether it's actually being used as a rental property, because as you likely know, a lot of these come on and off the market periodically. If they are not on the registry and they need to be on it, we send them a violation letter, which gives them about 7 days to get registered or have their representative register themselves. If they still don't take action, it could potentially go to our city's prosecuting attorney. And from there, worst case scenario, it could potentially be levied fines of up to $250 a day.
Around 1,700 individual entries have been submitted to the registry so far. Of the approximately 200 landlords represented in the database, about 70 are individuals and 150 are LLCs. That number has the potential to grow with the addition of short-term rental property owners. At its April 20th meeting, the Fayetteville City Council approved an ordinance to regulate short-term rentals within the city. To include short-term rental property owners in the landlord registry, Kurth says City Council needs to amend the registry ordinance so these property owners are not subject to the April 30th deadline.
What the City Council adopted didn't actually amend the landlord representative registry. They asked staff to bring that forward as a separate amendment because it's a completely different piece of the city's ordinances. So we'll be bringing that forward, and it will have its own 31-day enactment period associated with it. So I imagine that'll probably take about 45 days or so before short-term rentals could be expected. But they can register at any time if they want to be proactive.
In the meantime, information gathered from landlords over the last 5 months will become available to the public at the end of April.
There'll be a landing page on the city's website. I think we'll strive to highlight that, particularly on the main landing page for the first few weeks or months of it. Ultimately, it'll reside with the city's planning division, which is in the Development Services Department. So if you can navigate your way through our webpage, through Development Services to Planning, you'll find that information there.
Property owners who still need to register before the April 30th deadline can do so at fayetteville-ar.gov/landlord. There is no fee to register or to access and search the registry. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
Last week, the Museum of Native American History in Bentonville commemorated Earth Day by breaking ground on its latest project, an indigenous medicine garden. Ozarks at Large's Daniel Carruth reports.
Last Thursday, community members in Bentonville picked up hard hats and shovels to break ground on a new community garden.
All right. So on the 51st Earth Day, let the groundbreaking begin.
But this garden's mission goes a little bit further than just supplying residents with tomatoes or sunflowers.
We want to say before we begin that we want to acknowledge the first people of Arkansas, which were the Caddo, the Quapaw, and the Osage people. And as we stand in this present, we're looking at seven generations, where 51 years ago was the first Earth Day, and we're looking at those three generations that bring us today and what we do today that honors future generations.
That's Charlotte Buchanan Yale, director of the Museum of Native American History, or MONA, in Bentonville. The Three Gardens of Indigenuity is the museum's latest project focused on bringing community members together to learn more about indigenous plants and the peoples who cultivated them. She says MONA looked at gardening initiatives before, but had trouble securing land. Until in 2020, when the Runway Group, an economic development company in Bentonville, donated a piece of land off of 2nd Street and the Applegate Bike Trail to the museum. But then Buchanan Yale says their plan was stalled because of the coronavirus pandemic.
So we did some planting, but we had the Bentonville Garden Club involved, we had the Scouts involved. We want this to be something our community learns about indigenous plants and healing and the different properties that are natural. And so we had kind of a little pause.
And during that pause, MONA brought in Dr. Dan Wildcat with the Haskell Indian Nations University to lead a series on indigenuity for the museum's cultural celebration. Buchanan Yale says that series helped spark an idea and a name for the medicine garden.
So that's the word indigenuity is the tradition, is the idea of the first scientists and engineers of this land. If we are not indigenous to the land, they had already observed like a scientist, how you protect this land, on how land dictates culture. So I love this word indigenuity, and Dan Wildcat, just even be around him for an hour on, a talk makes my face hurt. He makes me smile so much. And so we are looking forward to building, the years to come around the idea of indigenuity.
At the garden site, Jeannie McIntyre, a museum and garden volunteer, surveys the land ahead of the Thursday groundbreaking.
And then all the plants that we have, I see sage. I think that's, I don't know what that's going to be. There's some cone flowers, some Mexican hats.
She says the museum raised $2,000 for the garden earlier this month, which was matched by partners Bogle's Garden City and the Runway Group.
And then coming into this spring, we reinvigorated the idea and tried to get additional partners and see how we could expand it to make it more meaningful to the community. What we're trying to do is reimagine the garden into a larger space. It'll have three gardens: air, water, land. And one of the things that we're really excited about, too, is that we'll be installing trucking and to track metrics of how the gardens are utilized and how many visitors we have, and kind of make it more interactive with the community.
And that's where University of Arkansas landscape architecture professor Scott Bealey steps in. He's been partnering with MONA to help bring the concept of indigenuity to the physical space.
So the thinking is to develop three gardens of indigenuity and how we can actually use design in the landscape to accentuate and call into focus these concepts of land, air, and water.
And Bealey says students from the university will help to collect and analyze data on the gardens.
So as people are in the gardens or leaving the gardens, we can measure how their thinking might have changed or how their thinking might have been influenced to regard the natural world around them and look at how are they actually working very locally in terms of improving the land, the air, and the water. And so in that respect, we can gather some data both in terms of people's experience, but also in its actual performance.
He says that data will all be collected using sensor devices that will be installed later this year. And while ground has broken on the garden site, Buchanan Yale says the garden is just in its first steps of development.
We'll gradually, bring in better soil than we had last year and start the process of the design. And so we'll look at more of a autumn, the first of when school comes back, to really begin, some of the design.
Yeah, I think in spring and summer, what we're going to do is mostly evaluate, plan, land amending the soil. And then in the fall, the students will be coming in. We need to assess what we have out there and what the best use would be. And the design will be established. And then come the fall, we'll start some planting, go forward from there with more spring planting, and it'll just kind of be an evolution. And we'll start with one, the primary garden is land. We'll move to air and to water. And then at the end, we'll be adding in all of the kind of measuring devices.
Buchanan Yale says lately the museum has been funneling more resources into outreach and education. And that's one of the primary goals of this garden, to give more community members access to education and resources from the museum.
What we want to do is, in the three gardens, is that there will be little identifiers, you know, and we, when you come into the museum, you're greeted by Tusker, our woolly mammoth, who's 12,000 years old. Our website is everything from animation to artifacts. And so Tiny Tusker is our animated ambassador that greets you, and he'll introduce story time, but he also introduces, what's in the medicine trunk today, kids? You know, so we have little vignettes on the website where we have Felicio Ruiz and Evan Alvarado will say, today, boys and girls of all ages, we're going to talk about honeysuckle, and the Arapaho use honeysuckle for this. So it gives more dimension to these little plants that you might be weeding out of your garden. You know, that plantain might be kind of handy if you're bitten by a snake. So, you know, if we start looking at plants as all of our relations, as our family, then we might be a little more respectful on what we eat and how we garden.
And for McIntyre, the garden is an invaluable asset in preserving indigenous culture.
One thing, I have two daughters that have Native American heritage. When they were growing up, there was no place for them to learn. And Mona's brought all this education into the area so they can understand where their roots are. And what I love about the garden is it provides an opportunity for a year-long learning environment. It's a way to educate about the First Peoples culture and educate the community, which no one duplicates this. I mean, this is something which, without Mona, wouldn't be seen by the community or accessible to a lot of the Native and Indigenous peoples that live in the area. And awareness is the key.
For Ozarks at Large, I'm Daniel Carruth.
Still to come on our show, we continue surveying the history of the University of Arkansas with accounts of the incredible challenges the first black students at the U of A faced. Our observance of the U of A's sesquicentennial continues in about 13 minutes. The University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences will host a COVID-19 vaccination clinic Tuesday from 3 to 8 p.m. at St. Vincent de Paul Catholic Church in Rogers. Pre-registration is available. Walk-ups, though, will be accepted. To reserve a spot, you can go to vaccinesignup.uams.edu/NWA clinic, or you can call 332-0222. We'll have that information again at the end of our show. Those requesting a shot will not need to provide a social security number, proof of citizenship, or legal status. Insurance information will be collected if available, but there will be no out-of-pocket expenses levied to anybody getting the vaccine. Everybody in Arkansas 16 and older is eligible for vaccinations. The Creative Arkansas Community Hub and Exchange, or CASH, will host reopening convening for Northwest Arkansas next week. The session, conducted on Zoom, is designed to help answer questions about a safe return for reopenings. The event is intended for people running arts and culture venues or those intending to host live events of any medium. Representatives from the region and from across the country will participate. You can register or learn more at the CASH Facebook page. And Northwest Arkansas Community College will host in-person graduation ceremonies Saturday morning at 9 and Saturday afternoon at 12:30 at Rogers High School's Whitey Smith Stadium. A ticket will be required for attendance. COVID-19 safety protocols will be followed. Attendees are asked to wear masks and stay socially distant. If the weather's like today, the sessions will be moved inside to the high school's arena.
This is Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. Any way of describing this past year feels like an understatement, but I hope that during these unpredictable and devastating times, you've been able to count on KUAF. If you value the news reports and interviews you hear on KUAF, please show your support today by giving at supportkuaf.com. Thank you so much.
And supportkuaf.com is open 24/7. You determine the amount that you contribute to your public radio station. If you've ever been thinking about becoming a sustaining member, giving a little bit every month, you can do that as well at support.kuaf.com. And from all of us and your fellow listeners who already contribute, thank you.
The Central Arkansas Library presents author and cultural critic Roxane Gay Thursday, April 29th at 6:30 p.m. Gay, the first black woman to write for a Marvel comic series, is the author of Bad Feminist, An Untamed State, and Hunger, A Memoir of My Body. This virtual event is free and open to the public. CALS.org for more.
This is Ozarks at Large for Wednesday, April 28th, 2021. Thanks for being with us. Yesterday, Governor Asa Hutchinson again asked for Arkansans 16 and older to seek vaccinations to avoid contracting or spreading COVID-19. This latest appeal during his weekly press briefing about the virus. The governor says, with the reapproval of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine for use, Arkansas is well-stocked to vaccinate anybody wanting a shot.
We have vaccines available in Arkansas. The supply is not a problem. We have vaccines available right now. Pfizer, 358,000. Moderna, 288,000 in inventory. And Janssen, which is the J&J, 70,000. And I was informed, Colonel Ader, that in my White House call today, that we will be receiving an additional shipment of Janssen vaccine this week, and so that will increase those numbers. Vaccines are available for you. We need you to go to your doctor's office, go to a medical clinic, go to a pharmacy, wherever you feel most comfortable, and make arrangements to get your shot.
As of yesterday, the Arkansas Department of Health calculates almost 30% of eligible Arkansans are now fully vaccinated, and not quite another 13% have received partial vaccination. In Northwest Arkansas, just more than 40% of people 16 and older are at least partially vaccinated. In the Arkansas River Valley, it's just under 30%. The governor says it's obvious the state has a challenge with vaccine hesitancy.
I think that hesitancy in Arkansas is partly because of the threat is perceived as being down. As new cases go down, hospitalizations go down, as you see people relaxing and trying to lead a more normal life, the threat is not with us every day, and so the urgency of getting a vaccine has been diminished. We want to, in a realistic way, continue to encourage people to get the vaccine as to how important it is.
The governor says the state will expand its efforts to encourage people to get vaccinated. He says he wants employers to help lead that effort by providing education about the importance of the vaccine, then providing access to shots. The governor says he'd like to see clinics at minor league baseball games, at malls, and more clinics available at schools. Dr. Jose Romero, the state's Secretary of Health, says virus variants in Arkansas are increasing dramatically. He says particularly the UK variant. He says the increase for that strain has been threefold in the last 7 days.
And this is only the tip of the iceberg because we're only sequencing a small, very, very small minority of the number of people that are sick. So it's here. We expect to see more. These isolates, especially the UK variant, we know is more transmissible and is associated with more mortality and morbidity.
And that increase, Dr. Romero says, is a big reason why state officials want more people to get vaccinated as soon as possible. The entire briefing can be viewed at Governor Asa Hutchinson's YouTube page. The U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs reports nearly 40% of veterans are refusing to get vaccinated for COVID-19. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports on how medical providers at the veteran healthcare system of the Ozarks are responding.
Chris Albritton is chief of pharmacy at the Veterans Healthcare System of the Ozarks, which operates a medical center in Fayetteville, as well as 7 VA outpatient clinics in the tri-state region.
Our pharmacy produces about 1.3 million prescriptions a year. And then, of course, when the vaccinations rolled out for COVID, we assumed all duties related to the distribution, drawing up, making sure they're stored correctly, et cetera, for in our case, Moderna originally.
And the cost for COVID-19 vaccinations to veterans is zero, Albritton says.
It was limited in the beginning. And then as time has gone on, just like in the community, you've seen more and more allocation as a vaccine was, produced more plentifully.
Plentiful now, but not all veterans are on board about obtaining the COVID-19 shots. The U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs is reporting that nearly 40% of veterans are refusing to be vaccinated.
We actually, the past two weekends, have had a stand down at our VA where we brought in multiple staff to call veterans over Saturday and Sunday and basically try to obtain that information on the ones that we don't have, whether they were documented as having the vaccine or not having the vaccine, or did you want to be scheduled?
A majority, he says, declined. Veterans were queried as to why.
They offer every reason you've read, whether it's on social media, the news. Most of them just say, no, thank you, I don't want it.
Jean Nelson, RN, is Health Promotion and Disease Prevention Program Manager at VHSO. She says younger veterans in particular have avoided getting vaccinated.
I think the fact, or I know the fact that it was an emergency use authorization, there was a little bit of hesitancy there. What's the long-term outcome? So there was a little bit of, that led into that waiting to see how other people were going to do and how they were going to tolerate it and what were the side effects going to be. And also of note, a lot of the people who didn't take the COVID vaccine are also those who don't want other vaccines like the flu shot as well. So they just have a general dislike for vaccines or just don't want the vaccines.
One quarter of Americans are now fully vaccinated, but according to CDC data, vaccine hesitancy is highest in rural states and in underserved urban districts. Rumors about vaccine side effects and safety spread via social media sites has been an influence. But things are shifting. CDC is reporting that reluctance to get vaccinated is declining from over 20% in January to 15% last month. Nelson says VHSO began to offer COVID-19 vaccinations last December.
And we focused on employees first, obviously, to keep our hospitals running. So the high-risk employees were vaccinated first. And then we very quickly moved into vaccinating the high-risk veterans. So again, we followed the plan very, very closely.
As determined by the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs COVID-19 response team.
And so we immediately developed a call center where we were reaching out to the veterans and calling them to schedule their appointments to come in. And we provided a drive-through clinic for them. So, of course, that high-risk group started with the 85 and older and those who might have transportation issues. So we did a drive-through clinic where they would not have to get out of their car. We did a lot of calling. We did vet texting, which is secure text messaging. We did secure messaging through email, and we also did letters and social media outlets.
Nelson says they're reaching out to wherever veterans are congregating, including regional American legions and churches, and especially trying to find homeless vets.
So I just think that we've had so many veterans that have taken the vaccine, young and old. And as we try and get back to what is normal life, the more protection that we can offer, you know, the better for them, to protect their families, to protect our communities. And there already are American heroes. You know, they've done so much to protect us. So this is one more step that they can take to protect all of us.
34% of VHSO enrollees have been vaccinated so far. The VA deployed an adverse drug reporting system for veterans and employees, which have reported very few side effects.
I think that, you know, initially, just because of the fear of it being a new drug of the emergency use, people were a little bit more fearful of the side effects. But the reality was very few people had anything more than a sore arm or very minimal kind of the expected side effects. And our veterans are very verbal about expressing that to each other. So I think that word of mouth spread and helped people realize that it was pretty well tolerated.
Nelson says veterans were able to more easily obtain vaccines compared to civilians based on risk stratification.
The veterans were very eager, but we were able to reach all the to make appointments available for everybody. at the main campus and very quickly at all the community-based outpatient clinics as well. So I think our veterans had a much less difficult time getting their appointments.
The Veterans Healthcare System of the Ozarks operates a 78-bed hospital in Fayetteville, including isolated care for veterans sickened with COVID-19, Albritton says.
We have had very low numbers, actually, inpatient at VHSO. I don't remember the last date we actually had one at VHSO in the hospital. We have a few in the community, and that usually ranges anywhere from 15 to 30 that are in the community. So actually very low numbers compared to the amount of veterans we actually serve. So you just feel like the shot has been working, watching the numbers over the last 3 months decline in the amount of our own veterans that have tested positive for COVID.
And with variants surging, the VHSO COVID unit is on standby.
So everything is still status quo as far as that. So if we did have a spike or influx, we could handle it. Obviously, we're much more prepared from the last surge that hit us.
And now Nelson says more veterans are asking about COVID-19 variants.
So the way that we're dealing with that right now is we educate that even though you had the vaccine, or you've had both doses and you're fully vaccinated, continue to socially distance, continue to wear your mask, good hand washing, all the safety precautions still need to be in place to minimize that.
In March, the VA announced that all U.S. veterans, including those not enrolled or qualified for VA medical benefits, could access at no cost COVID-19 vaccinations through their local VA medical provider.
If we can get it out there that our VA here in Fayetteville, Monday through Friday, we do walk-in clinics. So anybody can come in at any time, a veteran, spouse, caregiver, and they can come in Springfield also. So we do walk-ins, so no appointment needed or anything.
For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
And at ozarksatlarge.com, you can find a link that will take you directly to the Veterans Healthcare System of the Ozarks COVID-19 page. This week, the Arkansas Department of Health announced it's offering the Moderna COVID-19 vaccine at local health units in all Arkansas counties, available to anyone age 18 and older, including veterans. Appointments can be scheduled at local health units or by calling the statewide vaccine call-in line at 1-800-985-6030. 1-800-985-6030. We'll have that phone number again at the end of our show. The vaccine is available at no charge. This is Ozarks at Large. The University of Arkansas continues to mark 150 years of education, but for a majority of those 150 years, only white students were allowed to attend classes. Charlie Allison, the executive editor of University Relations at the U of A, continues his exploration of the century and a half of the university this week with accounts of some of the first African-American students to attend the school.
70 years ago this spring, the first two black graduates earned degrees from the Fayetteville campus. Jackie Shropshire earned a law degree, and Benjamin Franklin Lever finished a master's degree in agronomy, both of them graduating in June 1951. Jackie Shropshire is the better known of the two, mostly because the students who integrated the School of Law received more media attention during the period when they were in school, and in the years since. He was a native of Little Rock and graduated with honors from the highly revered Dunbar High School. Shropshire then attended Wilberforce University in Ohio, where he earned a Bachelor of Science degree in the spring of 1948. In the fall, he enrolled in the University of Arkansas School of Law. Silas Hunt had enrolled the semester before, but he withdrew from classes during the summer due to an illness that would take his life the next year. Shropshire, like Silas Hunt before him, endured the mockery of desegregation that the university carried out, admitting him to the School of Law but then requiring nearly every other absurd form of segregation internally. Because he wasn't allowed to live in the residence halls on campus, Shropshire boarded with the Joyner family in Fayetteville's black community. His outgoing personality meant that he made lots of friends in the local community. He had charm and an easy smile, so it was no wonder that he got to date the young local women, too. On campus, though, there was very little charm. Shropshire described the experience of attending the university as traumatic and difficult for him, especially his first year when he was the only black student on campus. He couldn't eat in the dining halls, he couldn't go to the law library, he couldn't even use the same restroom as white students. And like Silas Hunt, Shropshire was initially required to take most of his courses separately from the white students. Because of the large enrollment of returning war veterans at the time, though, he was allowed to attend two classes with other students, but even then he had to sit behind a rail that separated him from the rest of the students. Law faculty protested the classroom arrangement and demanded removal of the railing after news about the barrier went nationwide. The railing was removed, but Shropshire was still expected to sit in an assigned seat separate from the white students. Life got better the next year when two more black students, George Haley and Christopher Mercer, joined Shropshire in law classes. All three of them were gregarious and good at debate. When the Student Bar Association tried to give them membership cards in name only, they successfully argued for full participation in the association's social activities. Nevertheless, Shropshire said later that, quote, "There was always a sort of pressure. You were under it constantly. You had to be prepared for almost anything. You were marked." Later, asked his greatest moment at the university, Shropshire said it was June 9th, 1951, the day he graduated. He was more than happy to be shed of the university. After graduation, he became a successful attorney, practicing law in Little Rock for 5 years, before moving to Gary, Indiana, where he established a prosperous practice with emphasis on municipal law. In most ways, Benjamin Franklin Lever faced the same internal segregation, but in one significant way, he was allowed what Shropshire wasn't that first year. When the Board of Trustees and the President of the University, Lewis Webster Jones, discussed integration of the university's graduate school and medical school, Jones described the idea of separate segregated medical or agricultural facilities as absurd. Would a white student in agriculture be assigned one row of crops and a black student another? Would black medical students learn different anatomy than that of white students? Well, it boggles the mind. But then so did the idea of segregating students in a school of law, the very place where students should be learning that the laws of a state should be applied equally and without favor for race or ethnicity. And yet somehow that happened at the U of A. Nevertheless, Benjamin Franklin Lever benefited from President Jones's argument. Lever took classes alongside white students from the start. But like Shropshire, Lever couldn't live on campus or use the dining halls. He couldn't participate in the social functions of the university. Lever was born in the community of Niven on the southeast side of Pine Bluff, where he grew up. He earned a bachelor's degree from the Tuskegee Institute in 1938. He and his wife Helen returned to Arkansas and taught school in the Solomon Grove school system, about 15 miles north of Conway. He enrolled in the U of A graduate school in 1950 to study agronomy, and earned his Master of Science in Agriculture in 1951. His master's thesis was a study of germination in six varieties of grain sorghum, comparing untreated seeds and those treated with a fungicide called Arisan, but also looking at how well the sorghum seeds germinated depending on the moisture content of the soil. Lever found significant differences, but recommended a second study with a wider number of seed plantings. After finishing his degree, Lever worked with the Arkansas Agricultural Extension Service, teaching best agricultural practices to farmers. The teaching part of his job led him to return to the university to earn a Master of Education in 1955 and a Diploma of Advanced Studies in 1964. That combination of his agricultural knowledge and educational acumen proved a good one, and Lever served a very active and distinguished tenure of agricultural education in Arkansas. He taught for many years at the Arkansas Agricultural, Mechanical, and Normal College, the present-day University of Arkansas at Pine Bluff. He also served on state education commissions charged with improving primary and secondary education. To finish his career, he served as a dean at Shorter College in North Little Rock. Ironically, alongside Jackie Shropshire and Benjamin Franklin Lever, nearly 30 more black students earned degrees from the university in 1951. I won't be surprised if you've never heard of them. It's not easy to track them down. 26 African-American students earned degrees through the university's graduate extension offices that were quickly organized by the university in Little Rock and Pine Bluff. That big number of graduates in 1951, and an even larger number the next year, nearly 50, revealed a pent-up demand for post-baccalaureate study that had grown among black residents of Arkansas. It wasn't just two or three students seeking further education at the graduate or professional level. It was a ton of people. But the extension students didn't face the racial inequity and social ostracization that Hunt and Shropshire and Lever knew. So they never played into the publicity of the university or narrative retelling of the university's desegregation. And if they do fit into the narrative, alongside showing the desire for higher education, the history of the extension students also leaves a question about intention unanswered. Did the university start the graduate extension classes because of a recognition of the need? Or were the classes started as a way to reduce the number of Black students coming to the Fayetteville campus? I suspect both, but don't have any definitive answers there. A friend of mine, though, reminded me recently of a short line from Martin Luther King's letter from a Birmingham jail. In it, he wrote, "Human progress never rolls in on the wheels of inevitability." When Shropshire and Levers earned their degrees at the university, the U.S. Supreme Court was still 3 years away from making a decision on Brown versus the Board of Education. Rosa Parks wouldn't take her seat on a Montgomery, Alabama bus for 4 years. Jackie Shropshire and Benjamin Franklin Lever couldn't know at the time whether their enrollment would inevitably lead to continued desegregation at the University of Arkansas, but they stepped out on faith. Today, the U of A offers graduate fellowships in the name of Benjamin Franklin Lever. They're designed to increase diversity within graduate degree programs. We as a university need 1,000 more similar fellowships and scholarships with the names of Jackie Shropshire and Benjamin Franklin Lever and every one of those early extension students attached to them as a reminder that once the wheels of inevitability do start rolling, better things can happen.
Charlie Allison is the executive editor at University Relations at the University of Arkansas, and he's guiding us through some of the history of the U of A as the school celebrates its sesquicentennial. You can find out more about plans to observe the anniversary at 150.uark.edu.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten, in part, by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. Theater Squared presents At the Wedding. A hilarious, rough-edged, new world premiere comedy finds Carlo crashing a wedding with the best intentions, failing, forgiving, and finding a way to love herself. On stage through June 13th, 777-7477 or theater2.org for tickets and information.
This is Ozarks at Large. Dancers with the Dirana Academy of Classical Dance will do something this weekend they haven't done in some time. Student dancers will perform in front of a live audience. Friday night at 7, 7 dancers from the Academy will present The Exiled King, a story that goes back to the 5th century B.C., This week, we reached the choreographer of the performance, Miga Rao, by Zoom to ask her about the process of moving from virtual classes and rehearsals to this weekend's live performance.
So it was virtual classes that we had been doing for a year almost. And then because we did not have a studio space that was, you know, big enough to accommodate all the students with social distancing. So it was tough, but we still had to keep going at it just because something is better than nothing. Had I given off, you know, students that have worked for all these years would have, you know, lost majority of whatever they've learned. So I had to keep going. So we kept virtual classes going. And then, yeah, thanks to our Kifa Studio, you know, we've been able to get back to our in-person classes with social distancing, mask, every, you know, COVID regulations in mandate. Yeah, so yes, it's great. It's actually great.
What can you tell us about what we'll see on the stage at Walton Arts Center?
So The Exiled King is a Bharatanatyam dance drama, which we first performed in 2019 for our annual student showcase. We are presenting it again this year for Walton Arts Center's youth program on 30th of April at 7 p.m. It is a story based on Sage Valmiki's Ramayana, which is the oldest Indian epic retold through ages. So we are 7 dancers weaving in and out of character to present the entire Ramayana in an hour.
You mentioned this was staged in 2019. What was it like to revisit?
Yes.
Are you doing anything differently? What's it like for you?
Yes, so it is, you know, every time you perform a, you know, production like this, we go back, revisit, recreate, change. So, you know, because it gives a fresh feeling to it. So yeah, we've changed some of the plots. We've created some new elements. We've created some new steps. To give it a fresh look, yes.
How do you create a new step? I mean, does it happen first in your head? Do you watch the dancers and then go try this?
So, yes, both. So what we do is, you know, we listen to music for quite some time and get the feeling settled in our body and mind and soul. And then whatever comes out of it is the step that comes out of it. But then when we perform it, when we realize that, oh, it could be done something differently, so we change. And it also depends on the artist, how they want to try it and, you know, what potential do the artist has. So if I have some ideas in mind, I share it with my artists. I share it with my students and see what they can come up with. So it's that conversation in terms of dance that we have while creating products like this.
I find it so amazing that, you know, in 2021, we're so tuned in to words and the narrative. Whenever I see dance, whether it's ballet or jazz or modern or any kind that can tell a story through movement, it just blows me away. And I guess I don't really have a question here. It's just, it's something to behold, and I'm guessing that's what hooked you early on this art.
So many people think that Bharatanatyam or any classical form is difficult to understand, and hence, you know, we don't want to go. But, you know, I can talk in terms of Bharatanatyam is a universal language of body movement. And especially in Bharatanatyam, the move that we use to narrate story is nothing but the regular day-to-day moves, with a little more stylized way, you know, to present it to the audience. So you don't really need to understand the story or know the story. The way we choreograph it and the way Bharatanatyam is, you can understand it without even knowing the story. So if you are thinking you want to attend Bharatanatyam, but you don't understand, what do I do? You don't need to worry because, you know, the dance is such that you can understand even without the pretext of story.
What can you tell me about the dancers that we'll see on April 30th?
So we have 7 senior students of the Dhirana Academy of Classical Dance. And they're all high school students excited to perform, especially after the grueling years of, you know, pandemic. It is kind of relieving for all of us to be part of the show, and we are all excited to perform. So, yeah, they are happy. They're working really hard. They're working like almost 6 to 8 hours a week just to put this production, you know, at Walton Arts Center. Tickets are getting sold out soon, and, you know, I would want everybody to go and book the seats soon because we don't know when we are performing next. And I really want, because a performance without audience is a flower without color. So, you know, we need audience to watch us. We need encouragement. Our students need encouragement. Our community has to come together to, you know, help our artists, our students, keep the motivation going. So I request all of you to come purchase a ticket, you know, be our audience, watch, enjoy, and be part of our joy.
Meega Rao is choreographer for the Friday night performance of The Exiled King at Walton Arts Center beginning at 7 that night. We talked with her this week via Zoom. You can learn more about the show at waltonartcenter.org. And more young artists will be on the Walton Arts Center stage Saturday night when the NWA Jazz All-Stars perform. We're going to hear more about this year's edition of that ensemble on Friday's edition of Ozarks at Large at noon and 7 p.m. that day.
It's the Community Spotlight on KUAF. I'm Pete Hartman. Today we're joined with Scott Rampe. He's with Rampe MS Research Foundation.
Good morning to you. Well, we started in 2011 as kind of a grassroots organization that was started from my wife doing a triathlon here in Bentonville. She had always wanted to do one, and she was having a period of really good health. She deals with MS on a daily basis. And back in 2011, she was, very active and running and biking, not much of a swimmer. And so she came to me and wanted to learn how to swim. And so we taught her how to swim. And then within a couple of weeks, she did her own triathlon. And what happened was a bunch of my friends got involved, started hearing about it. And so they planned a surprise finish line for her. And when she crossed the finish line, we presented her with a check of about $1,000 that started the foundation. And we've been going strong ever since. We're a organization that's steeped in endurance sports. So we do, triathlons, we do duathlons, we do open water swims, kids races. And the next chapter of our events is the Trail Fest for MS that'll start this May.
That's right. It's called Trail Fest for MS. And this is a series of trail runs, correct?
Yeah, we had a kind of a mock trial last November just to kind of test the market and test the concept up in Bella Vista at the Back 40. And we invited about 50 people to join us, and it went off really, really well. And just because of COVID and trying to get, approvals from cities, some cities weren't even entertaining approvals, some cities were. And so we started bouncing around Northwest Arkansas, having conversations with several cities, and it turned into a series quite quickly. And so now we have a 4-city series, and it starts May 15th in Lake Weddington down in West Fayetteville. And then it will jump over to Lake Atalanta and Rogers in July, and then jumps to Blowing Springs in Bella Vista October 2nd. And then the championship will be right here in Bentonville at the new renovated junior high track there at Lincoln Junior High.
Proceeds go back into research for MS, right?
Yeah, exactly. Everything we do fuels our desire to fund the best research in the country. And we're very happy that we started funding the research here locally at the state of Arkansas. A lot of people don't realize that the state of Arkansas is blessed with a great research complex or research place down in Little Rock. And we started funding them. And then now what we've done is they make up our medical board, and they help us direct dollars to the best researchers in the country. So we've earmarked about 6 people, 6 research places that are the top in the U.S., and we're funding half of them now.
Speaking with Scott Rampe of Rampe MS Research Foundation, again, they're hosting that Trail Fest for MS series of trail runs. All right, Scott, someone wants to know more about y'all or these events. What's the best way to get the information?
Best way is to go to our website, researchms.org, and we're pretty grassroots, so they can contact me. I'm the face of the foundation and very involved. They can reach me at scottrampe@gmail.com. We're less than 4 weeks from Lake Weddington, so we'd love to see people start registering and coming out and helping us make this event, one of the premier events that we put on here in Northwest Arkansas.
Yeah, again, that first Trail Fest for MS event, May 15th at Lake Weddington here in Fayetteville. Scott Rampies, thanks so much for letting us know what's going on.
Thanks for helping us make a difference in this community.
The Community Spotlight and KUAF, Local Matters.
All right, before we go, some things to repeat. If you're interested or know somebody interested in receiving a vaccination at the UAMS Clinic Tuesday in Rogers, here's how you register. You can go to vaccinesignup.uams.edu/NWA Clinic. You can also call 332-0222. Walk-ups will be accepted. It's Tuesday afternoon from 3 to 8 at St. Vincent de Paul Catholic Church on West Poplar in Rogers. And if you're anywhere in Arkansas and want help setting up a vaccination appointment, 800-985-6030. This is 91.3 KUAF Fayetteville, a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. Contributors today included Antoinette Grajeda, Daniel Carruth, Jacqueline Froelich, Charlie Allison, Timothy Dennis produced today's show, The Community Spotlight, produced by Pete Hartman. We return with a brand new show tomorrow at noon and 7 p.m. Thanks for being with us. I'm Kyle Kellums.